Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, global leaders take on the issue of climate change. President Biden headed to Europe yesterday, where he'll attend the UN's climate conference in Glasgow, Scotland. It's the most significant gathering to address our warming planet since Paris in 2015. Back then, nearly every country in the world signed an agreement to cut emissions of greenhouse gases in an attempt to curb rising temperatures. And though many countries have made progress, scientists warn we're not moving fast enough. Umair Irfan is a staff writer at Vox who covers the climate and energy. He joined me Friday morning to preview what he'll be looking for at the conference and the factors standing in the way of progress here in the U.S. Umair, can you give us a sense of where we are right now and how quickly the Earth is warming?
Well, earlier this year, we reached a record high in greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere, 419 parts per million of carbon dioxide, and that's the highest ever recorded. And even though we'd signed the Paris Agreement, this international climate treaty, in 2015, greenhouse gas emissions have continued to rise. Now, we saw a bit of a drop last year because of the COVID-19 pandemic, but it seems the world has more than rebounded since then as people are rushing to catch up and make up for lost time. So while people around the world are more concerned about climate change than ever, we're also further off course than ever.
Further off course than ever. How come?
Well, it's been really hard to reconcile our needs for energy with our concerns about the climate. You know, we have wealthier countries that are, in fact, leveling off their greenhouse gas emissions, but per capita, per person, they're still emitting enormous amounts of greenhouse gases. So people who live in Europe and the United States live in larger houses, they drive cars that consume a lot of energy. And while that overall energy is staying flat or even declining, it's still an enormous amount. Meanwhile, the largest growth in greenhouse gas emissions we're seeing is coming from developing countries, you know, countries where people are generally poorer and they have much lower carbon footprints. And we've seen that energy is very closely linked to development. We haven't been able to break that relationship. So as we get people out of poverty and as we increase life expectancies, we find that people need more energy to live. And that is, you know, generally a good thing. You know, we're seeing people's life expectancies improve, their human welfare is increasing, and standard of living is going up, but it comes at a cost. And that's been really difficult for the world to resolve, that essentially there are billions of people in the world that still need more in order to improve their lives. And we need to come up with a way to allow them to grow their economies, to improve their lives, without also extracting a toll from the planet.
But are those countries like the U.S., like France, like Germany, who are more advanced, are they trying to do more to reduce greenhouse gases?
On paper, they're trying. I mean, certainly they're talking about it. And in practice, you know, the United States has actually seen an overall decline in its emissions since 2005, but that's largely because the U.S. has been replacing coal power production with natural gas powered production. Now, natural gas emits about half of the greenhouse gases of coal per unit of energy, but it's still a fossil fuel. And every time you build a new gas plant, you know, that's a 10, 20, 30-year commitment to continue burning natural gas. And a lot of environmental advocates say that, you know, we don't have time to transition this slowly, that we should be making more aggressive reductions. The other thing to keep in mind is that while the United States is the second largest greenhouse gas emitter in the world at the moment, behind China and ahead of India, historically, if you look at cumulative emissions, the United States is the largest emitter. So most of the greenhouse gases that are in the atmosphere, the largest proportion, come from the United States. And so a lot of environmental advocates argue that the United States and wealthy countries have a larger obligation to mitigate greenhouse gases. You know, the countries that contributed the least to climate change, you know, these island countries, some of these poorer and developing countries, they stand to suffer the most as they see things like sea level rise and extreme weather events. Whereas the countries that contributed the most, like the United States, the European Union, are more likely to be able to insulate themselves. They have the wealth and resources to protect themselves from some of the worst effects. And so there's this fundamental injustice that's been really hard to resolve in all of these climate discussions.
So how much of a difference has solar made? How much of a difference has wind energy made? I mean, we do seem to have taken some steps, but the question is, how much of a difference are these steps really making?
Yeah, they have definitely improved, you know, in clean technologies and renewable energy. They've dropped in cost vastly. In fact, in some markets, in some places in the world, it's cheaper to install new solar than it is to run existing fossil fuel power plants. And so the economic case is making itself. The problem is that we already are starting from a baseline where we have such high levels of fossil fuel consumption. We built the global economy on coal and oil and natural gas, and that transition is going to take time. You know, this happened over the course of nearly 200 years. We're not going to reverse that in just a few years or even a couple decades. And so while renewable energy is taking off in many places in the world, it's still in single-digit percentage points. And so overall emissions are still rising because we have this growth in demand. Even though we're meeting some of it with renewable energy, it's just really hard to counteract from where we are. We have a lot of path dependence, basically, where we have a lot of baked in emissions that we're having a really hard time, you know, changing course from.
So how much of what we've already talked about is going to be at the top of the agenda for this global warming summit that President Biden is attending?
I mean, this is going to be one of the core issues. You know, this meeting was initially supposed to be at the 5-year anniversary of the Paris Agreement, and that would have been 2020, but it was postponed because of the COVID-19 pandemic. But the idea was at this specific meeting, this is where countries would come to the table with promises to do more. Now, at the Paris Climate Agreement, the international community basically set a target of limiting greenhouse gases to less than 2 degrees of warming this century compared to pre-industrial levels, with a more ambitious target of staying below 1.5. But they knew at the outset that none of the commitments that they had were enough to reach either of those goals. The goal was that over time they would ramp up, and this is the first real check of that. So the most important thing is to make sure that countries are coming to the table promising to do more. Now, some countries have certainly done that. They've promised to do more. The United States is actually one of them. President Biden did increase the US's target for cutting greenhouse gases. But it's also been, as we mentioned, you know, a large rise in greenhouse gases overall. And so that's going to be one of the harder things to reconcile. It's one thing to promise that you're going to do something about climate change. It's quite another to deliver. The other big things that are on the table are these issues of justice that, you know, some of these poorer countries and developing countries are saying, we're being asked to do a lot more than we really should. And we deserve to be compensated in some way for the changes in the climate that are already happening. And we want help to transition our own economies to clean energy. And that is going to be a little bit more of a thorny issue because wealthier countries are less inclined to feel obligated to do things beyond their own borders.
Which countries have done the best in terms of reducing problems contributing to global warming?
You know, it may be surprising, but the United States is actually one of the countries that's done the most in terms of reducing its greenhouse gases. That's because
even though we're still at the top.
That's right, because we were starting from such a high place. And right. Again, as we mentioned, that, you know, the U.S. had a very, very dirty energy system for a long time. And so as the U.S. started shifting towards clean energy, because it's such a large economy, because we have so much energy that we produce, we were able to take a big bite of those emissions. Now, certainly a lot of people would argue that that's not still in line with our contribution to the problem, that we still haven't reduced it, but it does show that the U.S. can grow its economy. Our economy has grown over the past 20 years while cutting greenhouse gas emissions. And so at a certain point, you know, you can still make more money, you can still improve your standard of living without having to increase greenhouse gas emissions, and the United States is a case in point. Now, of course, there are other countries that have done far more as far as reducing emissions very much, much lower in terms of their overall percentage. Now,
such as,
you know, you look at countries like Costa Rica, you know, but this is a country that's basically aiming to be completely carbon neutral on a far more aggressive timeline than most other countries. But it's also a country that's, you know, blessed in terms of clean energy because they have a lot of hydroelectric power that they can draw on. Similarly, a lot of Scandinavian countries have a huge amount of renewable energy on their power grid because they also have a lot of hydroelectric power that they can use. And so some of these countries that have natural resources in terms of renewable energy are using that and are moving a little bit further ahead. The more difficult challenge is going to be in countries that don't have a lot of wind, sunlight, and water and trying to get toward cleaner energy. And we've seen those countries still make some progress. You know, Germany, for instance, has reduced its greenhouse gas emissions a little bit, but not as much as they would have if they kept their nuclear power online. So that's another big issue is, you know, the role of nuclear energy in the future under climate change. Germany wants to get rid of all its nuclear reactors, but also switch to wind and solar. And that's proven to be a bit of a challenge as well. And so every country is coming at this from a slightly different starting line. And that's part of what makes this really difficult, because it's hard to make apples to apples comparisons across borders when everybody is in a different place and has a different strategy.
So despite some progress, the world is warming more than it should be.
That's right. It's certainly warming, and it's warming at a pace that is not in line with the targets that we have set out for ourselves. And that's really the main contradiction going into all of these meetings, that everybody recognizes that this is a problem, but nobody is willing to do enough to solve it just yet.
What would the U.S. have to do in order to meet the goals set by the past summit?
Well, let's look at the overall goals for the whole planet. So the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, this is the United Nations scientific body, they looked at a couple years ago, what would it take to meet the 1.5 degrees Celsius target under the Paris Climate Agreement? This is the more ambitious target. And they said that in order to get on track, the world would have to roughly cut greenhouse gas emissions in half from current levels by 2030. So that's basically, you know, less than a decade from now. And then by the middle of the century, 2050, we would have to basically go to net zero. We would have to zero out our contributions to greenhouse gases. And then after that, we would actually have to withdraw carbon dioxide out of the air until 2100. So we have to
actively withdraw it.
Yes, we have to go to net zero emissions and then net negative emissions. And so we have to pull CO2 back out of the air in order to sort of level off the amount of warming that's baked in. And so this is across the whole planet. What that means, though, is if you look at this at a country by country level, that basically means pretty much pretty similar things. The U.S. would have to basically get on course to have its greenhouse gas emissions by 2030 and then net zero by 2050 and then negative thereafter. Now, if you look at what a lot of countries are proposing, they're roughly in line with that, that, you know, the United States' target is a roughly a 42% cut from current levels by 2030 and also net zero by 2050. But again, that's in line with the exact share as things stand now. A lot of environmental advocates say that the U.S. should actually go beyond that. The U.S. should be more aggressive because it's been the largest historical contributor to climate change, and that the U.S. should actually set an even more ambitious target for zeroing out its emissions.
So in the midst of this, you have President Biden going to this summit as Democrats and, of course, Republicans on the Hill are creating more and more difficulties for this idea of reducing greenhouse gases. I think of Joe Manchin in West Virginia, a state that was entirely dependent on the production of coal and the emission of greenhouse gases. Where does West Virginia stand? Just as an example of one state in this country.
Yeah, you're right. You know, coal used to be a major part of West Virginia's economy. But the story of coal in the United States has been one of decline. You know, we've seen an overall decline in coal employment for almost 100 years. And that trend has been continuing irrespective of administration, irrespective of like where we've been in terms of energy. And it's unlikely to be reversed right now. And so if you look at overall coal employment in West Virginia, it's actually a tiny fraction of the overall economy. You know, it's not a major employer. There are more people working in fast food industries in West Virginia than there are in the coal industry. It still has a huge cultural importance. And certainly for somebody like Joe Manchin, whose family is invested in coal as well, it may have some personal value to them as well. But big picture is that, you know, there it's been onward on the decline. And that's been a really hard thing to grapple with, you know. For the coal industry, they've been focusing on trying to salvage coal rather than trying to transition away from it, rather than trying to, you know, do buyouts for miners and, you know, get them enough money for early retirement and to fund their pension plans. And that's been part of the reason why it's been so politically contentious, is that, you know, there are still people whose lives and livelihoods are at stake here, and they're not eager to make this transition because there are very few other opportunities for them, you know. My heart goes out to the coal miner who's in his 50s or 60s and really doesn't want to retrain for another job. This is something they've been doing their whole lives. And I understand that, you know, in the U.S., we don't have a strong social safety net. And so for those folks, you know, there isn't really much in terms of an alternative. And so Democrats on the Hill were trying to develop a larger safety net with the recent bills that they're considering, but those are already being whittled down as well. And so that has the effect of, one, weakening the safety net for people here, but it's also weakening the United States' negotiating position as it goes into this meeting, because negotiators were hoping to have some definite money in their pocket and show the rest of the world that the U.S. was not only making commitments on paper, but was actually funding this transition in practice. And now, with those bills still under negotiation, they don't have that extra leverage that they were hoping for.
And what about China and its use of coal?
Yeah, China has promised essentially that they would get to roughly net zero emissions by 2060. But it's the targets in the middle between now and then that really show how serious they are. Now, China has consistently prioritized its overall economy and its economic growth over the climate. And they've used coal and they've shifted the global consumption of coal. They're such a large coal user that if China's coal consumption goes up and down, it moves the whole global market. Now, China is also running into limits of coal with regards to pollution. That's become an increasingly important political issue there. And that's part of what's driving their shift towards other sources of energy. And they are, you know, invested very heavily in solar and wind as well. They're just a very energy hungry country. But the Chinese government will also point out that if you divide everything that they're doing by their population, you know, close to 1.5 billion people, it's not overall, they're not the largest, you know, consumers of energy overall. Like, you know, they're roughly in the middle of the pack if you look at per capita levels of energy consumption and greenhouse gas emissions. And their argument is that, you know, we're still trying to lift a lot of people out of poverty. You know, we have high development in some major areas, but we still have a huge country where we're still trying to get energy and increase life expectancies and improve livelihoods. And so that's a challenge for them. For them, the bigger priority has been to try to, you know, improve the standard of living for as many people as possible. And climate change, you know, even though it has had effects on China, you know, we saw major torrential flooding and rainfall this year that may have been worsened by rising average temperatures in China. The bigger issue has always been, you know, boosting their economy.
And what about India?
The situation is very similar with India. You know, they're also a very large country, and they say that even though they are the world's third largest greenhouse gas emitter, they have a population to match. And so if you divide, again, by like the 1.2 billion people that live in India, you're looking at overall a per capita level of emissions that's roughly in the middle or near the bottom of the pack of countries. And so they're saying something similar, that we want to be able to get our people out of poverty and improve their standard of living, just as the wealthy countries have been doing for the past 200 years. And they're saying that it's unfair to ask them to make sacrifices at this point. That said, you know, they are also investing in clean energy and renewable energy. They do want to deploy more of these resources, but coal and these dirty fuels remain some of the cheapest sources of fuel, and they really need energy, and they're not inclined to make those cuts anytime soon. They said they could be persuaded if there is, you know, international funding. You know, if other wealthy countries are willing to contribute to a pot of money that helps finance clean energy, then yeah, they'd be willing to make some more aggressive cuts to their own output. But, you know, wealthy countries have been balking at that for years. Only recently have they finally secured enough money for this green climate fund that the United Nations has set up to finance clean energy in developing countries. They've been struggling for years to get adequate funding, and only recently did they announce that they actually meet their funding target.
So, Umair, it sounds as though what you're saying is this summit meeting is going to hear lots of speeches, making promises, but no real new thinking, new opportunities, new solutions. What do you expect?
Well, I do expect that countries are going to come to the table promising to do more. I mean, I think I do think that, you know, for a lot of countries, they want to save face, and they and nobody wants to be embarrassed as the country that came to the table promising to do nothing. Even, you know, some of the big coal emitters and even, you know, countries like Australia, which is a major coal exporter, and even Saudi Arabia have set net zero targets. So they're ostensibly on paper saying that they want to eliminate their contributions to climate change. And so that tells you at least rhetorically, there's a lot of pressure to do that. Now, the rubber meets the road with their, you know, interim goalposts and the money that they're actually willing to invest to make that transition. And that's going to be much more hard to hold people to account to. So that's one of the things that's going to be negotiated at this meeting is the checkpoints. You know, what are the milestones? When do we go back and review and look at where people actually stand? You know, the countries that, you know, are less enthusiastic, they want to have that as weak as possible. They say that, you know, at some point in the future, we'll invent some technology that's going to solve the problem for us. Whereas the countries that are more aggressive say that, no, we want to come back to the table every couple of years and double check and make sure everybody is making progress. We want a lot more scrutiny. And similarly, you know, there's going to be a lot of discussion about things like how countries are going to be able to trade with each other as they, you know, try to boost their economies. One of the big issues is exports around fossil fuels. You know, a lot of these countries, they set domestic targets, but they don't look at the coal, oil, and natural gas that they're exporting to countries, other countries. You know, even Norway, you know, which is really far ahead as far as domestic energy production, they're a major oil exporter and they're counting on selling oil to other countries. And that doesn't seem to be on their balance sheet. Similarly, some countries are also saying they want to be able to buy and trade carbon credits. So for the emissions they can't reduce, they want to be able to do things like, I want to restore a section of the rainforest. And by restoring that section of the rainforest, it's going to withdraw CO2 back out of the air and compensate for my emissions. Now, in theory, that works, but in practice, that has proven to be very problematic. The accounting around that is very difficult. So it requires a lot of measurement and validation. And that's also going to be a very thorny issue at the table, because again, the more scrutiny you provide, you know, the harder it is to actually do this. And then finally, the big issue is going to be how wealthy countries are going to compensate poorer countries that are suffering from climate change right now, the losses and damages that are they're already experiencing from sea level rise, and also this international climate financing. So there are a lot of issues on the table. Some of them we'll see progress on. Some of them are probably going to drag out for a few more years. And it's really remains to be seen what will actually pan out here.
A quick break. When we come back, the rest of my conversation with Umair Irfan. And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Umair Irfan. He's a staff writer at Vox who covers climate change. I wonder if the kind of climate change, if you will, that we're seeing all over the globe, certainly in the last couple of years, is going to provide any incentive to work and push a little harder and make those promises a little more than just promises.
I mean, certainly the impacts of climate change have now become, you know, impossible to avoid. You know, we always talk about, you know, climate change is a future issue, but it's important to remember the climate has already changed. We're seeing it now. The world is already about 1 degree Celsius warmer than it was in the Industrial Revolution. And we're seeing those effects now. In fact, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change put out the next version of its major scientific report earlier this year. And one of the things that they saw a big improvement in terms of their understanding is this whole field of climate change attribution. Basically, there used to be this thinking that you can't look at the signals of climate change in any individual event because climate is a statistical phenomenon. You have to look at trends over time. And they say that actually that's not the case anymore. You can look at things like heat waves or torrential rainfall or other kinds of extreme weather events and actually to calculate how much worse they were because of climate change. And so we can actually backtrace some of these effects and calculate the economic toll, the human toll that has already been caused. And so because of that, because we have such a much stronger link, we can do things like calculate insurance and calculate the financial losses and the potential risk there. And once we can quantify that, then you can actually come up with a business case for addressing climate change in the present. Once you can show that there's a definitive loss potential, you can make the case that we should invest in reducing greenhouse gas emissions now. So the global insurance industry is actually something, a group that's actually working really hard on pushing for more aggressive action on climate change because they know they're the ones that are going to be holding the bag if climate change continues unabated. And so you're seeing a lot of countries, a lot of companies starting to recognize that and pushing for more aggressive action because it's going to start hurting their bottom line.
Are the smaller countries going to act as a group to push against the larger, more economically viable countries to band together and say, we've got to have more on our side and you've got to do more on your side?
That's exactly what's happening. You know, we've seen in these climate negotiations, smaller countries, you know, teaming up. You know, there's a bloc called the Association of Small Island States, like the Marshall Islands, Fiji, Tuvalu, and all these other countries that are seeing sea level rise literally consuming the land that they live on. And they're saying that this is an existential threat. Like within our lifetimes, we won't be able to live in parts of our countries. And this is a problem that we didn't cause, but we are going to suffer from it. And so what they're doing is working together to try to build their leverage. And they've been pushing for more aggressive targets. You know, I said earlier that, you know, at the Paris Climate Agreement, the initial target was 2 degrees Celsius with a more ambitious target of 1.5. These small island countries have been pushing to make 1.5 the new target. Basically, the default goalpost has to be this lower goalpost because we know that the worse climate change gets, the more that temperatures increase, the greater the impact and the more that they're going to suffer from it. Similarly, we've seen countries in sub-Saharan Africa working together to try to come up with a case for more international climate finance. Basically, they're saying that we need more money to be able to transition away from fossil fuels and towards clean energy. And they've been pushing for, you know, more money, more investment, and more technology sharing to be able to make these changes. And so, you know, you have these big economic powers at the table, but then you also have these groups that are trying to exert their leverage together as well. And that is one of the big tensions you see in these big international climate meetings.
I would think, however, that the United States, considering what's been happening in our country with the fires, with the floods, even in New York City, even in Connecticut, even parts of the East Coast that didn't used to face this kind of problem, I would think there would be a growing incentive on the part of the U.S. to do more and more and more. But is that where the Congress steps in and says, sorry, we're not going to give you enough money to do more and more and more?
I mean, the entire U.S. political structure, especially at the federal level, has been pretty dysfunctional, and there are structural problems that we can't overcome. That said, though, I mean, the United States conducts every few years this report called the National Climate Assessment, and they reported a few years ago that just about every part of the country is going to be adversely impacted from climate change.
Exactly.
And where we do actually see some action is at local levels. Cities and states are actually trying to move ahead because they know that the federal government isn't advancing the ball enough. So you may recall, you know, a couple of years ago when President Donald Trump at the time, pulled the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Agreement, a group of cities and state governments were saying, we're still in. We're still concerned about climate change because it's affecting us. We can't avoid this problem, and we're still going to do our best to try to mitigate it. And so while our federal and like national level leaders may not be able to move fast enough, there are certainly some parts of the country that are seeing problems like sea level rise and extreme heat and are trying to act on their own. Now, that is reassuring to some extent, but again, climate change is a global problem that requires global action. And so while we can try to do things as individuals, we also, there's no substitute for working together and taking big bites of the apple as far as reducing emissions. So it cuts kind of both ways. You know, you have small actors working on it, but you still need the big picture commitments.
Is there also a big pot of money to which both small countries proportionate to their size and large countries contribute once these Paris Accords year after year are completed? Is there a pot of money to be distributed fairly?
There isn't one single program for doing that, but there are several different ones, and they're sort of piecemeal. And that's also part of the problem, is that some of them are bilateral. You have two countries that are basically working together. You had countries like Norway working directly with the Brazilian government, for instance, to restore parts of the Amazon. But I mentioned earlier the Green Climate Fund. This was an agreement that was separate from the Paris Climate Agreement, but it's often negotiated at the same meetings. And so this was a program that set a target of deploying $100 billion per year in climate financing. And so this is to fund things like seawalls in coastal countries, or to develop regenerative agriculture or crops that are resistant to drought and extreme heat in many of the countries that are going to be facing those problems. But they've had a hard time securing commitments. And only recently did they finally say that we have enough wealthy countries chipping in to meet this target. Now, some of the developing countries have now been able to assess their own impacts of climate change and calculate what their risks are. And recently, you know, there was a group representing the countries in Africa, and they said that they calculated that the damages from climate change they're going to see is about $1.3 trillion. And they're saying that we need, you know, roughly 10 times as much money than is currently on the table in order to actually cope with climate change and to reduce our contributions to the problem. So there are some efforts underway, but they're probably a small piece of what we actually fully need in order to make this transition and to make it fair and equitable.
So with all these efforts on the part of climate specialists, politicians at the top of each country, doesn't it come down to the industry bigwigs who hold back progress?
I think that's certainly part of it. You know, there is sort of a failure of imagination. You know, a lot of people are locked into the mechanisms that brought them to where they are. Nobody wants to rock the boat, especially if you got wealthy from the way things are. If you're a fossil fuel company, if you're an industry that counts on a lot of cheap coal, oil, and natural gas, you know, nobody wants to change that because that's proven very lucrative for them so far. But the impacts of climate change, like we said, are, you know, becoming impossible to ignore. Even oil companies are being affected by this. You know, there are oil companies that are doing drilling in the Arctic Circle that now have to actually refreeze the ground that they're working on because the permafrost beneath them is melting. And so, like, even oil and gas drilling operations are being affected by things like sea level rise and extreme weather. And so they have to start coping with this as well. And so the question is then, how do you construct a global economy that's vastly different from the one that we have now and only in a few decades? You know, and that's a challenge. I mean, like, I don't think there isn't going to be an easy answer. And I also think that there are going to be, frankly, some people that are going to lose out on this. You know, some people who work in these industries are not going to have jobs that they thought they would have. And so the question is, how do you make sure that they're looked after, that they're compensated, or that they're not made less, that they don't lose out on this? That has to be part of the equation as well. And that has also proven to be really difficult. And, you know, we also need technology. You know, we need to be able to improve wind and solar, but also come up with ways to produce reliable power at the scales that we need. And we need more energy overall, because again, you know, we know that especially for developing countries, more energy improves their standard of living. And so we need a way to actually improve and lift everybody in the world out of poverty and to give them, you know, a meaningful way to pursue all of their ambitions. But we have to do that within the constraints of our climate, that, you know, we also don't want to make the overall situation worse such that more people are struggling than are benefiting from this. And so, yeah, it requires leadership. It requires imagination. And frankly, you know, we're not seeing that at the scale that we need.
So this week, President Biden introduced a new proposal for his Build Back Better plan that does include some money for climate change. How much is in there? How much good would it do? And what would it do?
Right. So the latest framework that the Biden administration put out for this budget reconciliation bill, it's been whittled down quite a bit from the initial $3.5 trillion to about $1.7 trillion. And in there, there are still some significant things on climate change. You know, they invested about $500 billion in terms of spending for climate-related items. The big ticket ones are things like tax credits for renewable energy and also for electric vehicles, and also some measures to help communities cope with some of the effects of climate change, so building up resilience. But there were some things that were removed. And so one of the big ones was this the CEPP program, which is this clean energy payment program for utilities. This would pay utilities money for meeting clean energy targets and would actually find the ones that are falling behind. And this was supposed to be a really important lever for actually shifting power generation in this country toward clean energy. And that was one where we would, the U.S. would expect to see some pretty big gains. Another one was a fee on methane. Methane is another greenhouse gas. It's actually way more potent at trapping heat than carbon dioxide. So reducing methane has outsized benefits as far as the climate. And so doing more to restrict methane is hugely beneficial, and it's an easy way to make gains in the near term. But methane is, you know, the dominant fuel in natural gas, and a lot of the natural gas interests oppose that. And so that methane fee for pollution and emission was removed from that as well. So there are some steps forward, but some of the biggest steps that we that climate advocates were hoping for did not make it into this latest version. And it's not finalized either. So there's still some ongoing negotiations. President Biden left for this climate meeting without having this firm deal in hand. And it could still get, you know, eroded further. That remains to be seen.
So considering all of this, what's the best that could come out of this climate change meeting?
I think the best that we can hope for are commitments from just about every country that would put the world more in line with the goals of the Paris Climate Agreement. So if you looked at the last round of commitments, that would actually get the world to roughly 2.7 to 3 degrees of warming, so well above the Paris goalpost. So if you were to take these current commitments, if we added them all up in terms of reducing greenhouse gas emissions, the ideal thing would be for, at least on paper, these commitments to get us below 2 degrees and get us below 1.5 degrees. So that's one thing that would be ideal. The next thing would be to see them put it into practice. So countries actually committing to invest money and resources to meeting these targets. And then also to see them actually reconciling and also reckoning with their contributions historically to climate change and working to develop a framework to compensate developing countries that are seeing the impacts of climate change severely right now. So if you can hit those three things, that this would still be a fairly successful conference, even if it doesn't get the world perfectly in line. Now, the reason why this is also so important is, again, in order to meet that 1.5 degrees Celsius target, there's a limited window for action. You know, with climate change, we can't punt to the middle of the century to actually start getting our act together, even if we invent some magical technology to suck CO2 out of the air completely to compensate for everything. The CO2 emissions we emit now are going to be in the air for centuries. You know, everything that we're doing now, we're going to be reaping the dividends of in 2050, in 2100. But that means is that everything we do to reduce CO2 emissions now will benefit us for the coming decades. And so that's why we really need to see a lot of immediate action. And that will be the biggest thing to see coming out of this meeting. How many countries and how much of the world is committing to doing something now?
But realistically, what do you expect?
I think we'll get a lot of pledges on paper, and I think we'll get some pretty tepid action. I mean, I think we're going to see some countries claiming that they're going to stay on their current course. So the ones that are on a downward trend are going to continue on a downward trend. Some countries are going to claim that they can bend the curve and start, you know, peaking and then declining their greenhouse gas emissions. So countries like India and China are going to probably talk about increasing their greenhouse gases in the future for a little bit and then eventually declining. But overall, I think we'll get closer to our goals, but not quite there yet. That I don't think that all the commitments, when added up, will bring us fully on course with what the world set out to do in 2015.
Mayor, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That was Umair Irvine, a staff writer at Vox who covers climate change. And that's all for today. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody, with help from Sandra Baker. Our engineer today is Michael Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. Be well, stay safe. I'm Diane Rehm.